The meeting will come to order, the Civil Justice Committee. Representative Champion moves the minutes of the January 28th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Is this tough? Are people sleeping? Is there something, is there some gas in the room that hasn't hit me yet or knocking people out? What? We need eight? Oh, okay. Well, we'll wait on your motion. Oh, yeah. You were all coming. Okay. Today we have a presentation on the juvenile justice system by the Juvenile Justice Coalition. And both Kurt Peterson and Cheryl Krager are here. And I hope all of you can read those charts from your seats here. No, you should have colored handouts on this. So basically, I'm not sure who's going to start out. Kurt Peterson, you have to state your name and your position and then go ahead with it.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mullen and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Peterson. I'm director of the Juvenile Justice Coalition of Minnesota.
Okay.
Proceed.
Just go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have two packets. Thank you for inviting us to present today to your group. We have just some basic materials we'd like to cover, and then we really want to get into the mapping project that Ms. Krager has completed earlier this year. Just real quickly, the JJC is referred to it as a system change and advocacy organization. We are a statewide organization of professional organizations, juvenile justice leaders, and community organizers. Our goal is to work towards creating an integrated and unified juvenile justice system for the state of Minnesota. We consider ourselves a convener and an innovator in trying to bring best practices and research to the work that we're doing here in the state of Minnesota. The JJC is made up of over 35 member organizations representing most of the leaders we think in the state as it relates to juvenile justice in Minnesota. We very strongly want to follow the 9 tenets of juvenile justice reform. If you look in the packet that I think was given to you on the front page, we have a fact sheet that just gives basic information. You'll see towards the bottom of the page that we have the foundations of work for the 9 tenets of reform. The 9 are reducing institutionalization, reducing racial disparity, ensure access to quality counsel, creating a range of community-based programs, recognizing and serving youth with special needs, creating smaller rehabilitative institutions, improving aftercare and reentry, and then maximizing youth, family, and community participation, and keeping youth out of adult prisons. The JJC is the Minnesota member of the National Juvenile Justice Network based in Washington, D.C. We were the 32nd state that joined this Washington group. There are 37 states in the country that have an agency similar to JJC working in their state. The other pages in the packet basically gives you an organizational chart of our work. That's just page 2 in the packet that just kind of gives an overview. Again, the JJC feels that it can take a lead in some aspects of its work, but we also feel like we should not take a lead in other aspects, meaning we would work with other organizations already here in the state. For example, NAMI of Minnesota, JJAC, there's other groups here in the state doing good work, and so we want to work in partnership with them. So this second page gives you an overview of how we're organizing our work. Pages 3 through pages 7 is just our roster of our members. We're very pleased that we have a fairly broad list of, as we said, juvenile justice leaders in the state. So it gives you a listing of those members that we have. And in the very back packet, for your review, are the juvenile justice legislative priorities. We have 8 that we are suggesting that we want to focus our attention on. It gives the brief overview of the eight, and then some a coverage, a little review of what work we're doing on each of the eight priority areas. And also, there are some of these priorities that are being led by other organizations here in the state. So this is a packet that gives you some basic information about the Juvenile Justice Coalition. Representative Mullins, if that would move into the mapping project, and then we could take questions after that, at that time, or would you care to...
Now that we have a quorum, Representative Champion again moves the minutes of the January 28th meeting, so all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Wow, great response from last night. All opposed, no? Okay, carries. Yes, Ms. Krager, could you just state your name and position, and then go ahead and explain this, the extensive mapping system here.
My name is Cheryl Krager. I'm the Associate Director with the Juvenile Justice Coalition of Minnesota, and I am going to explain to you the detailed map, the second packet that you would have. This is the title page of it. And on your second page is, I'm going to give you just a little brief overview of what the maps are all describing, and then I'll go through more in detail each one of them. But your first page, if you look in the display in front of you on the floor, you can see different colored boxes, and those have significance, and I want to highlight those for you right now. The orange boxes on the map represent times when a young person is reoffending and reentering the juvenile justice system, or they are exhibiting behaviors or things that would lead them to be at risk for joining the juvenile justice system again, and so we wanted to highlight all those steps in the process. The green boxes represent contacts that a young person has with all of the different systems players as they go through the juvenile justice system and even the prevention piece. And you can see that it's pretty extensive if you look at the map here on the floor, just how often that happens. And then the yellow boxes represent when a young person gets programs or services with their involvement in the system. And the reason why we wanted to highlight those is they really represent times when we can implement evidence-based practices, model programs, those effective programs that we know that work that can also save us resources as well. And then the blue boxes are very significant in that they represent gaps in the system, places where young people are falling through the cracks, or just where the system isn't working very well. And then that seat and the next seat in your packet just give a brief description of each of the maps following, and I'm going to go through those now with you in some details and highlight some significant pieces of those. Okay. The first number, page number one, is what we wanted to do was give you an idea of the young people actually at risk of joining the juvenile justice system, so it looks like this. And so researchers have identified risk factors that young people could potentially have that would lead them to involvement in the juvenile justice system. We thought it was important to start with that. And then the bottom of that page has the resiliency factors, the strength that we want to build up in young people so that they don't enter the juvenile justice system. And if you go to page number two, this talks about prevention, and it also talks about how children actually are starting their entry into the juvenile justice system. National research has identified that most kids that are involved in the juvenile justice system are actually showing signs of behaviors or struggles in school at age 7, but their average involvement in the juvenile justice system doesn't happen until age 14. And so this represents some of that 7 years that kids are showing behaviors in home, at school, they're struggling with school, you know, they're just struggling, they might have mental health issues, and what this highlights is when that happens in a young person's life, who sees that and what is their response? And so if a parent sees it, they may typically go to their physician. We know that a lot of kids get their mental health treatment through their primary physician and maybe not through a mental health provider. We know that maybe a parent's going to try to go to a nonprofit organization or handle it internally. And then we also know that they may go to the schools or kids showing those signs of behaviors and struggles in school, and so the schools are either going to use their discipline policies, they might try the special education route, or they may refer them to community-based or mental health issues as well. And we also know that some kids are showing signs early on, even in early childhood. But what this is trying to show is that depending upon who sees that behavior in a child, and whether or not they know that the resources exist out there really is going to determine whether or not a child gets the help that they need so that they stay out of the system. And then if you look at number three, this talks about the mental, I'm going through this quickly, so if you have questions, please feel free to ask any. It's quite detailed. And on number three, we know that a high percentage of the young people involved in the juvenile justice system actually have mental health or chemical dependency issues, and this shows the mental health system and how you access those services, which can be quite complex and really depends upon whether or not a young person gets the right diagnosis, whether or not they can access county services, what kind of insurance they have, what that will pay for. We also know that a lot of young people enter the system through special education as well, and so we wanted to highlight that system as well. There's a very high percentage of kids involved in the juvenile justice system that are actually already in special education. And number four is the school discipline policy, and the reason why we needed to highlight that is because a lot of kids nowadays are entering the juvenile justice system through the schools, and while we don't have really good hard data on it, we do know that, for instance, in Sakota, Ramsey, and Hennepin counties, which are the three largest counties in the state, it averages about 20 to 30% of the cases that the county attorney processes starts in the school system, and that's not including truancy. And so when you and I were in school, you know, fights might happen or things might happen. The school handled it internally or parents handled it. Now young people are being charged and they're entering the juvenile justice system as a result of those behaviors.
Sorry.
Is that 20 to 30% of the juvenile cases?
Yes.
They're all cases. Okay.
You're welcome.
Thank
you. And then on the bottom of this page, it shows the truancy because that comes through the schools, and we know that truancy is an entry offense for kids to continue further on and continue maybe reoffending in higher level offenses, and so that is significant. The piece that I wanted to point out on this is on the left hand side, there's two big white boxes, and the top has offenses or behaviors that a child might commit that they would handle most likely internally within the school. But the bottom box are things that a child could do that could potentially lead them to referral to police, which is very different, and that's very significant for kids. And then the yellow boxes on there are significant because they show where we can try to prevent kids from entering the system through the schools.
Ms. Krager, I have a question, if it's okay to go back to the special education issue. You said a lot enter system through special education. Now, is that through something to do with the school, and do our special education monies, can I notice there's things about services here through the school, does that go towards helping these issues, some of our special education money, or I'm not that familiar with that. I can ask a real detailed question. Maybe you can help me.
Okay. Chairman Mallory, what we see is that a young person, they're in special education potentially for behavior issues, and they exhibit this behavior in the classroom, let's say, and then because of the level of that behavior, the teacher may file a report. Maybe they hurt a teacher or they did something in the classroom. And so even though it's the results of their behavior and the results of why they're getting the special education services in the school, they end up actually being charged with an offense because of that behavior that happened in the school, and they enter the juvenile justice system that way. Does that...
That's partly.
Okay.
Do you know, and Ms. Krager, do you know whether or not the school services or other services for them can come from the special education money in the K-12 formula?
As far as I know, I'm not an expert in this area.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, thank you. If you look on number five, this is really the entry point for young people into the system, and it's their contact with law enforcement, whether it's a community police officer on the street or whether it's a school resource officer, or even if they commit an offense in a facility or out-of-home placement. And if you notice the red line, we like to highlight that. And basically, if you would look on these charts, if they could stay to the left of that line, they would stay out of the juvenile justice system. And if they cross over to the right of the red line, they would be in the system formally. And the key piece here is that the response varies depending upon where a child lives and depending upon what the police decide to do in response to a behavior that a young person commits. And then the other piece of it that is significant to law enforcement is that if a young person, and we don't want them to be housed in a detention facility because we don't want kids there, what happens is they can only hold a child for so long, and if they can't find a responsible adult or guardian or parent, they struggle with what to do with the kids. And so on the right of that page, if you see all those green boxes and then that blue one, that's the significance of that, is when we talk to law enforcement, they really struggle with what to do with the kids. And where should they take them? So they end up maybe taking them to shelters or getting them involved in the child protection end of things, which is not necessarily the most appropriate either.
So. Oh, Representative Fulmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you give us a little more information about your statement about this red line and what happens determines by where they live? Are there general trends, metro versus rural, size of counties, are kids treated different? Can you explain that?
Ms. Frager.
Sure. Chairman Mallory, members of the committee, all I know is more anecdotal data. We don't have real specific data. That is one of the challenges of the system. But, like, for instance, we did a lot of work. The map in front of you is actually Hennepin County. And so, for instance, in Hennepin County, a young person in, let's say, Plymouth may have a BB gun, and, you know, the police might be called, and they may just give them a warning. But the same thing might happen in Minneapolis, and the kid may be charged with carrying a weapon, which is a completely different offense and a different response in the system. And it's really because of they live in Minneapolis versus Plymouth. Or, you know, some of the suburban cities may just give kids a warning when they pick them up if they're just kind of hanging out on the street, where in Minneapolis they may be brought in because they're hanging out in the street corner. And it's just a different response, partly because of the environment of Minneapolis. So.
Representative
Fulmer,
thank you.
So are you suggesting, based on the data, that where a person lives sort of hinges upon whether we start them down this track of being criminally involved in the judicial system versus some other area where there's this notion of protecting their flight in the juvenile justice system?
Ms. Krager?
Chairman Mallory, members of the committee, yes. That is what some of the data is suggesting, especially around overrepresentation of youth of color.
So I'll naturally assume that you're going to talk about how there's intentional strategies, even within the system, to help delete, for lack of a better word, the overrepresentation of children of color that are part of this system.
Ms. Krager.
Chairman Mallory, members of the committee. Yes, we will talk about that later in our presentation.
Very good, Chairman Mallory. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, what has led generally, what are some of the factors in your mind that have led generally to this increased propensity over time for kids to be pushed into the system rather than it to be dealt with in the school?
Ms. Krager? Or
Chairman Mallory, members of the committee, what has happened historically, I'll give you a little bit of background, but in the 90s there was this increase in juvenile crime, and partly as a result of that, states across the country have punished children more than they had in the past. That's where we saw a lot of the adult certification bills happening around the country. And so partly as a result of that, also the schools started implementing the zero tolerance policies, which really is the piece that comes into play in terms of the kids getting in trouble in the schools and getting into the juvenile justice system that way. I think some of it also is the amount of resources that schools have available to them now to address the needs of kids who may be struggling or maybe have some behavior issues. They do have some limits on what they can do, and so what's happening is now is they're sending them into the juvenile justice system as a resort because they maybe don't have the resources and they don't know what to do with some of the children's behaviors as well.
And just for instance, I'm Representative Drazkowski. I know, for instance, at Patrick Henry, they did have some systems that were to try and deal with that at the school, and working with the local police and then all of that money got cut, so that's what happened on that. But I think you had a follow-up question. Or didn't, I thought...
I was training my limited mind on what you had to say, Chairman Lowry, and I lost my train of thought, but it may come back. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Krieger.
I think we're on number six. All our members of the committee. What happens is a child is picked up from police, and then they, depending upon the level of the offense, they're brought into the police department, and they go through an intake, and that's what this slide shows. And the really key piece here is that there are some law enforcement agencies around the state that will, instead of referring a child on to the county attorney's office, will divert them to a community-based program or an in-house program that they're operating to, especially low-level offenders. And we are actually working on a pilot project in Hennepin County to increase the use of law enforcement diversion for young people in Hennepin County. And it does get at some of that geographic diversity or disparities issues, and the fact that currently in the county there are some law enforcement agencies who do divert children and there are some who don't. And so the response, whether or not you end up in the system, really depends upon which city you live in that particular county. And so we are working with law enforcement there and the community-based programs to try to increase the number of kids who get diverted at this contact level. So, and the other piece of this on the slide on the bottom is the intake procedure for juvenile heading into the detention facilities. And I included on here using a risk assessment instrument. There are three counties currently, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Dakota County, that have piloted this. And it's a way to use a subjective instrument to determine whether or not a child should be held in a detention facility or not. And what it does is it determines if the young person is a risk to public safety or a risk of failure to appear at court. And depending upon their score that they get on this assessment, they may be held in detention or they may be sent to community-based alternative or electronic home monitoring or have a phone call to make sure that they show up for court. But it's a way to reduce the number of kids who are held in detention in the state. And so we also, there is also starting the pilot project up in St. Louis County, and we have a bill being proposed this session to try to implement this statewide.
Representative Olin.
Yes, just a question, I guess. As a former prosecutor, I don't have I never had a written plan in 32 years as county attorney, but that certainly does not mean that people are false. Pennington County and myself did not have one.
The next one is number 7, and it just shows that once the county attorney gets the paperwork from the law enforcement in that process. And here in Minnesota, all the county attorneys are required to divert young people out of the system if they choose. And so we know that, although there is no statewide data on it, just anecdotally we know that there's thousands of young people that are diverted from the county attorney's step of the process and kept out of the system. And they're typically referred to community-based programs within their counties. And the other piece of this is that depending upon if a child is held in custody in a detention facility or out of custody, that time frame can be pretty long. And if you've worked with young people enough, you know that they tend to need an immediate consequence to their behavior. And so sometimes a kid can come to court maybe 3 months after they committed the offense, and they may not even remember what they did, or they may commit new offenses or different things. And so that is a challenge within the system. Number 8 is just really briefly public defender and eligibility, and it's determined upon income and the level of offense and whether or not a child is at risk for going into placement in Minnesota. So that was pretty short and brief.
Ms. Krieger, yeah, that was really short. I didn't mean to rush you that much. I actually have a question. Is there any study of the effect of the new style of the school to not allow the teacher to do any disciplining and instead having to refer it over? Do you think that that has had a positive or negative effect on forcing more people into the system?
We're not aware of any study of that. I've not come across that or aware of that study.
and nobody's looked into it. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens to the child whose parents' income is too high for a public defender, but they refuse to get one? Are these kids at a disadvantage, or is there a way to ensure all kids have representation regardless of their parents' income? Or
Ms. Prager?
Representative Mulley, my assumption, and I'm sorry to say assumption, is that they get the full access to the public defender even if their income is higher, if they refuse to pay for their own public defender.
It partly depends upon the level of offense.
Yeah.
With our statutes, if we're required to provide them one or not. So the first couple, like if it's a petty offender, they wouldn't get a public defender.
And Mr. Chair, is there any instance where, depending on the income of your parents, you would not get a public defender, where if your family didn't have resources, you would? So in other words, at any point, are children of a higher socioeconomic status disadvantaged if their parents won't do it for them?
Mr. Peterson? No.
I'm not sure what answer.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you had followed up into the vein of discussion I wanted to explore earlier. Characterize, if you will, what are some of those added liabilities that schools have gained in burden over time that have in essence forced them to push some of these kids into the system? I know Chairman Mulry had mentioned resources aren't available for some of the programs that were in some of the schools, but I know there's been added legislation over the past years, these zero tolerance policies, which, as we all know, can be very problematic. What are the top factors there that push people into the system from the schools in terms of policy?
Mr. Peterson, or
a lot of questions. Excuse me, Representative Mulley, members of the committee. Questions regarding the schools. I don't know those top reasons. I think to the reasons we've heard so far, that it is a resource issue, and it's also happens to be policies that have been more penalty-oriented over the years. To the other details that you're asking, I could get you that answer, but I don't have that.
No, I don't.
I just have a quick quip, Mr. Chair. I imagine somebody has been in the system from playing King on the Mountain because you can't play that in school anymore. That's supposed to be funny.
This line of questioning reminded me of my first day in high school. And does anybody here remember Magnum PI? And do you remember Rick on there? The short guy that ran the bar. My first day of school, I walked down the hall to my second class, and the football coach had a guy by the shirt and was banging him on the wall. That was Larry Minetti, who later became Rick in Magnum P.I., and Baba Black Sheep and different, or not Baba, what was Black Sheep Squadron and things like that. He used to sit next to me in class, but he's an interesting character. Sorry, I diverged, but that's a little different from what happens now. Ms. Krager, go ahead.
Okay. This is number 9. It's the arraignment, trial, disposition, and it's a pretty complex map trying to show the process that young people go through once they get into the courtroom in front of the judge. And what I'm only going to highlight here is the two blue boxes. We have in statute that young people held in detention have a mental health screening done to try to identify those youth that have mental health issues. And also once a young person is, if they're adjudicated delinquent, but the challenge is that different counties have different processes on what to do with that information, and there is a real struggle with, if you do identify a young person with potentially mental health issues, what is the next step in the process? And what do you do with that score from the assessment, and how do you get them connected potentially with like human services or other services? And so that's the reason why those two are highlighted on here. And this is pretty similar what it would be across the state. There's a little bit different. Some counties will have a probation officer attending all hearings. Others may not be able to due to funding issues. So that is that very complicated process. And then the number 10 is just the pretrial motions. And this covers the process for adult certification and our EJJ process here in Minnesota. And also the top part covers the if a motion is filed for competency for a person in the system. So it's a complicated system.
Oh, Representative Champion.
Question, is there a racial disparity or geographical disparity between those who are faced with adult certification and or EJJ?
Ms. Krager?
Chairman Mallory, members of the committee, I believe there is. We do have a little bit of challenge with getting data here in Minnesota, but there is that adult certification.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, Ms. Krager, you say there is an adult certification, but you're not sure on EJJ?
Right, I'm not sure on EJJ, but I do believe there is overrepresentation of youth of color in terms of adult certification in the state. But I'm not 100% sure.
As a follow-up on that, do you know whether there's a discrimination based on the same circumstances?
I am not sure on that. We would have to look at the data to determine that.
And Ms. Krager, when you say in this state, is there any distinction between different counties also?
As far as I know, I would have to look at the data on that to make sure. I do know that, for instance, in 2006, we had 98 young people that were certified as adults in Minnesota in that year. So, but I would have to get more into the data to look at the detail on that.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And once again, I'm going to my prosecutor's hat from the olden days. There is one county up in northwest Minnesota, and it wasn't mine, that per capita would have been higher than the metro area. On the other hand, there are also many counties up in northwest Minnesota that probably never have used EJJ. So it varies.
Ms. Krager, back to your presentation.
To go to number 11, if a young person is adjudicated delinquent or a petty offender, then they go on to the correction system, and depending upon their level of offense, they may go into minimum supervision with correction staff where there's very high caseloads. They do very little except for make sure they fulfill the court requirements such as community service. And then young people that score higher on the risk assessments will have greater supervision. And the piece that I wanted to point out on this is this map really is dependent upon the individual county and what services they have available for young people, and this really does vary across the state. Some counties will have some evidence-based practices already in place, some don't. Some have more community-based resources available that they can tap into to help young people with their needs. Others don't have maybe as many, especially out in the greater Minnesota, the rural areas. The other piece of this is there are a lot of young people in the system that either have an existing case or have a closed case within human services, whether it's child protection or mental health. And so there is, I'm trying to figure out the right word, confusion. And to determine whether or not those young people should stay in under human services caseloads or they should be under a corrections caseload or should they share the caseloads or what they should do with those kids that are dual between both systems. And even though we don't have really hardcore data, we do know that there are a lot of kids that have been involved with the child protection system that are also involved with the juvenile justice system. And I don't have that in the map yet. That is one that I'm working on because they kind of run parallel. So we need to add that to it. But that is why that particular box is in blue on here. And then this is really a place where we could implement those best practices and those model programs that we know reduce recidivism, keep children from reoffending, and help address the needs that they have.
Ms. Krager, I have a question. How how do they distinguish who gets what as far as that? And I mean, the money systems are different here. We've got all these little silo committees, and it seems like these in the real world all intermesh. And how does that work out with an individual here? Is it just by chance which system and whether you get better funding or less funding for the help? Or do you understand my question? Go ahead, Ms. Gracier.
Chairman Mueller, members of the committee, we need to do some more research on this, but the little bit that we have, it depends upon the county and the relationship that their Department of Human Services has with their Department of Corrections. Some work quite well together. They maybe have shared staff, and so they're able to share data. A lot of the challenge is the fact that they can't share the data between them because of data privacy issues. So it does depend upon the county. Some have agreements between the two departments so that they can talk to each other. But in some counties, they don't know if the child has a case open in human services necessarily unless the parent or the child says something in an intake meeting and it comes up. And then they might be able to get permission to then talk to their caseworkers to find out what's happening. And so that is a really big challenge for the system. It's how do those systems work together with these kids that do cross over between them. And I have to say that it's a challenge around the country. It's not unique to Minnesota.
Well, Ms. Krieger, they have even worse silos than we do. Okay. Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm looking through this paper here. I have a kind of objectives in your plans of action. And the one question sticks in the back of my mind that I'd like to have answered, and then probably I might have another one after that. I'm guessing that there's a correlation between kids that come through this system and a lack of a two-parent home. Are there statistics out there on a two-parent home versus a one-parent home and how many kids go through the system?
Mr. Peterson?
Chair Mullery and members of the committee, yes, there are statistics. I'm not able to cite any, but it's fairly true and proven that children that have two parents will have a lesser chance in the juvenile justice system.
Okay. Because I see, you know, on here a list of, you know, on site. thank you, Mr. Chair. Invest in prevention and youth intervention. And is that something that parents are involved in? I guess what my question ultimately gets to is what can we do to better equip parents to stay together when maybe that's way out of this league here, but I see that as the overreaching problem here is the lack of a two-parent household, and what can we do to help this problem by, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
Mr. Peterson, I'm not sure if you're going to solve
well,
the issue of how you
take care of members of the committee. For example, I'm not sure I can solve that exact problem, but I think there are agencies that are looking at providing education support services to families and parents of children who have been involved in the juvenile justice system. And so I think that they're notwithstanding whether they have one or two parents, there are things that we can do as a community to support these families. So we have a better sense of understanding the system and having a better chance for the child to get out of the system and into a healthier environment.
Yeah, I guess that's basically what I was getting at. You know, shouldn't we be focusing on... Sorry. I'm a freshman, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Kerr. I just feel like some more resources need to be going towards that, and since that seems to be kind of a common factor. Do you understand? Thank you.
You know, it would appear to me that may be one of the issues, but what I would point to, for an example, is early involvement. So I want to get back to that early involvement question because I think that would lend itself well into this discussion with Representative Scott. It is my understanding from your earlier testimony is that there is a decision made early on with a police officer or anyone else as to how they're going to deal with a person, namely a juvenile, when an infraction is believed to have occurred. Some are taken home, others are put into the criminal justice system. And disproportionately, I think you said that the empirical data would suggest that juveniles of color, 9 times out of 10, maybe that's not the number, but a large percentage, are placed into that process or that juvenile process. So with that being said, here's my question. Does early involvement in the juvenile justice system by a minor impact the juvenile's future.
Ms. Krieger, you look like you might answer that.
Yes, Chairman Miller, members of the committee. What we are finding now, and that it used to be if a juvenile was involved with the juvenile justice system, that involvement was kept private. And when they became an adult, 18, and they were moving on to try to be a productive member of a society, that information was not out there. But now what we are finding is a juvenile record is impacting young people as they enter adulthood. They are not securing employment. They are having trouble with housing. We're finding out that, for instance, a young person may go to school, college, become, you know, get education in nursing, a nursing assistant. They have a juvenile record. They go to apply to get a job in that particular field, and because of our licensing rules, their juvenile record is being accessed, and they are not, they're being denied employment in those fields. And so what used to be very private, you know, due to a juvenile mistake, perhaps, is now impacting their adult life and their ability to secure employment and housing.
Representative Kulik, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier and I had a brief conversation about this because I have in my practice that exact situation where I've got a 23-year-old client who 7 years earlier as a 16-year-old had two juvenile offenses. They didn't rise to the level of felonies. They were juvenile offenses. And, in fact, once he was through with the system, he, you know, cleaned up his act and has a college degree. And his juvenile record keeps popping up. And I mean, because if he applies to rent an apartment or a job, they ask for a consent to do a background check. That consent is a blanket consent. And, yeah, these things keep popping up, and so as a matter of fact, what it came to me for was expungement. And I thought, wow, 7 years later, college degree, and we've got two stupid teenage acts that are preventing him from, you know, getting a job and renting an apartment.
Representative Champion.
You know, I want to ask this a slightly different way, because I definitely appreciate the information that you so eloquently stated, because I think that's important. But the nuance that I was asking was particularly around if a juvenile gets in the criminal justice system early on, do we believe that adds to the perception, be it the juvenile's perception or the perception of the person who decided to place he or she in the criminal justice system, that this particular person belongs there versus another person who does not belong there? And if that perception drives their conduct later on, so that they will, in fact, participate in additional criminal behavior, opposed to at the top, where there's a perception and a thought that is implemented by saying you go home and you are not supposed to be involved in that. Do we have any data that would support my contention that perception is both defined at that moment, both by the juvenile as well as the person who could make the informed decision to send the person home?
Ms. Krieger?
Chairman Muller, members of the committee, at this point, we don't think we have the data on that particular issue that you're asking about.
And I promise that this is my last question. I really promise. I heard you talking about data collection, and that sort of perked my interest because, of course, I'm thinking of some legislation around this. But what impact would racial data collection have on our conduct in the criminal justice system, if any?
Ms. Krieger.
Chairman Muller, members of the committee, we are actually looking at that issue this session as well. And one of the things that it would do, if we could collect the data at the different decision points within the process of the juvenile justice, then we could get a greater understanding of what juveniles are actually entering the system, and at those different decision points, we could get the racial data, the ethnicity data, the gender data, geography data, and that would help us determine and be able to look at those responses. Are they different because of a child's race, ethnicity, or even gender, or, you know, is it, you know, different response depending upon the offense? And it would give us some of that detail that we need to look at policy, potentially making policy changes, in determining why we do have an overrepresentation of youth of color in the system. But right now, our current data collection across the state does not collect it uniformly at all of those key decision points, and nor is it being collected at all of those decision points. So it is difficult to try to come up with those policy changes or recommendations because we just don't know.
Thank you. Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Almost done. We go to number 12. This is probation reoffend, and once a young person is on probation, another way that they can enter the system again is if they violate probation, which is, and then whether it's a new offense or not going to school or something, so that happens here. The other piece is if a young person is on minimum supervision, the county may not be able to provide them the services that they need just because they're on minimum probation, so it's not required. And so they may still have these needs or issues in their life, and so they may get referred to a community-based program, but it's up to that family then to follow up and get their child the help that they need, and that may or may not happen, which means they may then continue behavior and end up back in the system. I'm almost done. Number 13 is out-of-home placement. We don't have the exact number of how many young people are actually sent to placement here in Minnesota, but it's pretty significant, and it costs a tremendous amount. And so what this diagram just shows is the top part shows Red Wing and the programs that they have at Red Wing, and that's for our juvenile males only. We're a very high-level offense. And then underneath that, depending upon the county, they may have an internal placement facility, such as Ramsey County has Boys Totem Town, Hennepin County has the Hennepin County Homeschool. They may send young people to a private facility that they contract with, or they may send them out of state if they feel that we do not have the services here in Minnesota. And so it just depends upon that.
Representative
Fulford. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this was something that you looked at all, but... Now, I'll disclose my bias here, but I believe really strongly that chemical dependency without a mental health component is basically just throwing money away. So where are we, do you know, with that? Do most juveniles that get referred to chemical dependency now have the opportunity for a mental health component, or are we still doing the silo thing and having one without the other?
Ms. Craver?
Representative Mallory, members of the committee, I'm not exactly sure. I think it's still more the silo approach. I do know because of the statute they do have to have the assessment done if they've been adjudicated delinquent, but that is one of the challenges. What do they do with that data? And I do think the chemical health piece is not addressed as well as it can be in the system. What we've heard from some kids is they'll go to a placement facility and they will have both. They'll have a mental health issue and they'll have chemical health, but they may be sent to a place that just addresses one and not the other, and so they're not getting both needs met. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think I'm seeing Ms. Afterholden nod yes to that answer.
Thank you.
she's with NAMI. Representative Kulik-Jackson.
Quickly, I'm going back to page one because I'm thinking about policies and kids, and I appreciated Representative Scott's question about the association between single-parent households, and that brings me to my question, and that is the association with being in the juvenile system and poverty, because I wonder if the single-parent household and juvenile system relationship has more to do with families in poverty because the single parent then maybe just a divorce and a single parent, because when I see about the trusting relationships, access to health care, so can you just confirm that there's more of a poverty relationship than necessarily the family structure?
Ms. Craver?
Representative Mueller, members of the committee, what the research that I have looked at has shown some of that correlation. The other research that I've shown is that it has more to do with the instability of the family as well, and that correlation with their involvement with the system, whether or not that relates to being in a single-parent household or just a family that's very dysfunctional and struggling with it. Potentially parents are struggling with mental health issues or struggling with the reality of living in poverty. So that also has a correlation. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Craver. I think you're back on 13.
Okay. I don't think I have actually anything more to discuss on 13, and so I'm going to just go to the last one, which is 14, which is affidavit entry. And we do have it. Do we have it up there?
Yes, it is.
It's the last one on here, and this is for when a young person comes home from a placement facility and the services that they get. Redmond is on the top because I spent some time with them to get their detailed, and the bottom part is just more of a generic. We do have a statewide work group with the JJC looking at this issue because we do not have any statewide standards or anything in the statute that says what should be in place for a young person when they come out of placement to help them succeed so they don't end up back in placement again or reoffend and end up in the adult system. And so we do have a group looking at what we need to put in place based on research best practices, based on research that we've done with probation officers and facility staff here in Minnesota that they know works with kids and what doesn't work, to try to improve this piece. But what I want to point out is if you look at where this is in this long line here in the front, it's at the end. We spend a tremendous amount on young people all the way up to that last stage of the process. We don't spend as much resource on the kid once they come out of placement. And we've made a huge investment on them up to that point. And then somehow we expect them to succeed when they return back to a community that for most of them hasn't changed from the community they left to enter placement. And we don't necessarily give them all the support that they might need to help them not reoffend and come back into the system. And that is the end of our map.
I'll bet you spent a half hour assembling all the research and data and to put this together. Did anybody else have questions on that? Yeah, I think it really points out the trouble we face in trying to, and that they face in trying to deal with it when we're broken down into so many silos, and this obviously shows the way that so many committees and finance committees are involved in this system and not really understanding the connections they have to each other. I believe there's a few. Oh, Representative Kelly.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just speaking to that, since you brought up the finance side of it, I know this isn't a finance committee, but we're talking on the public safety side, that, you know, the per diem rates there at the adult facilities that are running around $85, and since you had Red Wing in there, it piqued my curiosity because it was upwards toward $200. And I was just wondering if you could point to any specific box or boxes that show us where that big jump is.
Ms. Krager?
Could you repeat? Which box? I'm sorry. The cost?
Thank you for the cost.
For placement or for the whole system?
Just
for Redmond, it would be with the staffing, and they do actually a very good aftercare system, but it's actually, I'm not sure on
that. Don't have those details.
I'm sorry. I don't. I would have to look it up.
Is there any other questions on
that? Okay. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Normally, in some of the larger counties, we see efficiencies of size, and yet my own experience with juveniles is in a small rural county where when I was representing juveniles, their caseworker and the probation officer and the guardian ad litem and the attorney all work together, and there was real integration because the caseworker was working with the entire family, and ironically fewer resources, and yet is it your experience that there's a little less siloing when all the parties can stay together?
That's crazy.
Chairman Mulley, members of the committee, yes, that would be correct. I think it's a little bit easier for the smaller counties because they don't have the numbers. They don't have such high numbers of kids so that they can work together. And they have smaller staff, to be honest, so they all know each other. They probably are in the same building, you know, and so they can come together and meet on families and young people, where the larger counties, when you're talking about a couple thousand kids, it's a different dynamic then. And so you have a lot more staff involved, and it's much harder, I think, for those systems to work together.
on that. Was it Mr. Peterson? You mentioned you could quickly go through. I know this Juvenile Justice Coalition is a pretty huge collection of different groups involved. You mentioned that they had some kind of a agenda for the session. Can you very quickly go through just the highlights of it or something like
Thank
that?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Mulry and members of the committee, excuse me. Thank you. If you would go to the first packet, the kind of the back of the packet, you'll see a sheet that has a headline of Juvenile Justice Legislative Priorities. Our group met this morning. In fact, we have over 45 groups that are currently meeting. This roster of priorities came out of 14-month process where people really talked about what they felt would be very important. So the eight that you see checked there is number one, eliminate overrepresentation of youth of color. You'll see that right now the Council of Crime and Justice and Council of Black Minnesotans are currently taking the lead in that work. Number two, support youth future employment options. That is also a group of Council of Crime and Justice is taking a lead on that. You'll see that described in the bottom of page one. Number three, stop criminalization of youth with a mental illness. NAMI Minnesota is the lead agency for that priority. Number four is do not enact Adam Walsh Act. Basically, there is no lead, but we all we know that things are happening, going in the right direction, we think, with that. Number five, continue to serve youth aging out of placement facilities. Again, Minnesota Council Child Caring Agencies in NAMI Minnesota are taking the lead with that particular priority. Invest in prevention and youth intervention programs. Minnesota Youth Intervention Program Association, YIPA, is taking the lead with that particular priority. And then defining youth violence as a public health issue. Lead is City of Minneapolis. It's more of a discussion topic at this point, looking at the application to defining violence as a public health issue. And then number eight is... I have the other last one is on the sheet on page three is protect prevention intervention programs and Minnesota judicial system. So this kind of fits into the invest in prevention youth intervention. So those are the priorities that we're working at this time.
Mr. Peterson, I suggest you also work with DEED. I know there's some people at DEED that are interested in that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Other questions? Okay, well then, thank you for appearing and letting us have a little better understanding of all our different problems and idea of where we have to try to bring things together. With that, the committee is adjourned.